It is October the 4th, 2012. I am Steve Growick, the webmaster of www.gerweck.net, Growick.net, your source on the World Wide Web for all your pro wrestling news since 1997. It's always a pleasure to welcome guests to Growick.net. Today I got a former manager, even though that's kind of a dirty word today in wrestling. He was also the ECW general manager, did a great job managing one of those upcoming superstars I thought was going to be a huge star in business. Unfortunately passed away, Umaga. Today I give you Armando Estrada. How you doing today, my friend?
Well, I'm doing better than most, and of course the pleasure is all yours, and thank you for having me. Ha ha.
Well, I think a lot of people were surprised. It recently came out that you, even though you were not on WWE television for a couple of years, you were actually still with the company in some capacity, I guess in a creative role, and then you just recently departed the company. What was going on from the time you were off television to the time you just were departed the company? What was your role specifically with WWE? What did you do backstage?
Actually, I did not have a creative role. I was brought back in right around January of 2011. I was brought back as an on-air personality, or so that was the thought, and nothing ever materialized. So I wasn't a talent that was sent to developmental because, quite frankly, they didn't feel that I needed to go to developmental for what they were going to be asking of me, which I was led to believe was going to be an on-air manager or agent, whatever the term is, for another talent. So I was actually just sitting at home for the better part of a year and a half collecting a check and kind of waiting for the phone to ring, and unfortunately that never materialized into anything, so at least not this time around. So, but yeah, I was with the company from early 2011 until my release in July of 2012, so... You know.
And what did they tell you at the time of your release? What was their reason why they let you go?
We're still paying you? No, it was it was more like, it's funny. I can joke about that, but I honestly do believe, you know, in wrestling, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And if you're not around the decision makers every week, if they're not seeing you in some capacity, if I had been in developmental and I was around the trainers and the team that's down there in Tampa, Florida, not having that privilege, I guess, or not having that ability to be in their face every week, I think hindered my chances of being used on TV. So I think it was just like, there's so many talents between the main roster and developmental, you know, you're talking well over 150-ish talents, okay? And I'm just one talent out of that 150, although a very good one in my humble opinion. Nothing materialized for me, nothing panned out. I sat at home. They sent the checks. I would submit ideas regularly. However, like I said, nothing panned out. I didn't have anybody really backing me. Like I said, an agent or a writer or a trainer. So at the end, it just didn't make sense for them to keep me on payroll. And quite honestly, it didn't make sense for me to stick around with the company in hopes of something coming along and just, you know, you don't get time back in this business or in life. You don't get that time back. So for me to sit on the bench for a year and a half collecting dust and rust, and I'm another year older, you know, I'm another year removed from performing, that isn't doing me any favors. So it was a lose-lose situation. It was not really a lose-lose, but more so they weren't benefiting and neither was I. So the time to move on was beneficial for both parties. And, you know, if that door opens up in the future, like I said, timing is everything. And, I don't think anybody has seen the last of me.
Well, I hope not, because as I was telling you offline, I thought you did a great job as a manager, even though it's kind of a dirty word in wrestling anymore, a manager. But that's what you were. You were a manager for Umaga back in the day, and which seems like it's so long ago now. As you said, you know, the years just, you know, another year removed from performing. Now the years just kind of they add up, because it's been several years now since you know, were a television character. I think it was 08 when the last time we really seen you on air, you know, when you were the general manager of ECW. So how frustrating is that? Because you did have a good run, I thought, when you know, when you were a manager, when you were the general manager of ECW. How frustrating is that? You know, they're keeping you at home. They're with the idea maybe they'll bring you back at some point. And like, you know, you said you're submitting ideas, and obviously you're keeping track of the product, the characters, storyline developments, et cetera. But how frustrating is that, knowing that the run you had and what you can contribute to WWE or ECW, that they don't bring you back, they don't give you that phone call to say, okay, come on back Monday, you know, we have something for you. Just how frustrating is that?
It can be pretty frustrating when you know that you belong amongst the elite in this industry, in this business that we call professional wrestling. My resume, my track record, speaks for itself. I don't think there's ever been a performer, at least not in my, you know, in my years, that was able to capture the audience as quickly as I did. You know, that's, you know, you can go back and watch and you can say, wow, this guy started in April, and by May or mid-May, he had the audience in the palm of his hands. So yeah, it's frustrating when you know you're good at doing something and that you're not given the opportunity to do it. You're not given a platform to do it. So, but, you know, it's not my company. So as a, I can only do what is asked of me and what's, you know, if you present me with an opportunity, then I'll show you what I can do. You know, if you give me that chance to make a difference, I'll make that difference, and I'll give you a return on your investment. So, but without a platform, without the television time, without a microphone, how can I show you how good I am? It's like asking a baseball player to be good at what he does, but you take his bat away. Well, how am I supposed to swing for the fences? How am I supposed to improve my average? How am I supposed to show you that I can drive these runs in if you're not giving me the opportunity to? So, yeah, it's frustrating, but it's life. Things don't always go your way. And like I said, one door closes, another door will open. Timing is everything. And, you know, I've always had a good relationship with the decision makers at WWE, so that if the opportunity presents itself, then I wouldn't be surprised if my phone rang, although, like you said earlier, it doesn't seem like there is a commitment to the role of a manager or agent or mouthpiece, if you will. And that's something WWE needs to figure out. If they want to commit to the mouthpiece, then do it. If you don't, then just don't bother. Let the talent get over on its own, or say, we're gonna commit this talent, we're gonna commit this manager or mouthpiece to this wrestler, and we're gonna give them 6 months. Either it'll work or it don't, but we're gonna give them 6 months, or we're gonna give them 3 months. You know, I didn't need 6 months, I didn't need 3 months. You know, within 6 to 8 weeks, I had shown that I was capable of engaging the audience and making them invest in me, and in turn investing in the wrestler Eddie Fatu, aka Umaga. That didn't sound right, actually. Umaga. That sounded better.
That definitely did. I just wondered, you know, we were talking, the role of managers have definitely diminished over the years, I guess, to a great capacity of probably the early 90s, when we saw like more valets pop on the scene rather than managers per se. You know, when I think of a manager, I think of Bobby the Brain Heenan, Jimmy Hart, Luscious Johnny V, James J. Dillon, you know, those types of managers that were very successful. They had stables, they help get their talents over, especially like talents that were not great communicators. They could talk for them, as you said, a mouthpiece for them. Why, just a general question, why do you think we've seen that role diminish? Because I know I've talked to so many people in the business, they're just like, you know, wrestling changes and things move on, and I'm just seeing so many good talents in WWE, but they could benefit so much by having a mouthpiece, having somebody that could talk for them, could help them get over a little bit with the crowd. Why do you think, just in general, the role of a manager has just kind of diminished over the years?
Well, I think it's, again, the decision makers. If Vince McMahon and Triple H and Stephanie McMahon, you know, if they decide to move away from that facet of the business, you know, who are we to tell them otherwise? You know, yes, it's been proven successful in the past, but, you know, it's their business to run how they see fit. So maybe it's a financial move, because now you're committing, you know, you've got to pay Armando Estrada to go out there with Umaga or with another talent, for example. So you've got to fly Armando Estrada in and out. You know, there are costs involved. So the same thing with tag team wrestling. It can be more expensive to produce a tag team match versus a singles match. And at the end of the day, you know, in their eyes, they may be getting the same return by paying two guys to go out there and perform than paying four guys to go out there and perform, or four guys and a valet, or four guys and a manager. They may be getting the same return. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So it is a total, you know, it, and I'm not saying that that's the reason, because business in WWE and just in a lot of businesses is not what it was pre-2008, right?
True.
Although you have seen, to a lesser extent, not exactly the 80s that we talked about with Bobby Heenan and Jimmy Hart and Freddie Blassie and Jim Cornette and Jim Dillon, you know, you're seeing some male managers out there. I just don't think that they're just not getting the time that their predecessors did. You know, there's Ricardo Rodriguez, you know, there was AW, and I was enjoying his work, Abraham Washington. There's the Sakamoto, the guy who manages Tensai, but we haven't seen him do anything. We don't even see him anymore. So again, I go back to that commitment. They're not fully committed behind the manager, you know, and with the exception of Vicky Guerrero, there hasn't been an on-air manager or valet besides her for a number of years. I mean, she's been the only steady one. And, you know, Ricardo has come around, the last two years or so. But that's about it. So we talked about the valet, and, you know, the valet took away, you know, the valet took jobs away from the male manager. So if the powers that be, like I said earlier, maybe they believe that the valet will sell more tickets than the guy who picks up the mic and talks to people. Maybe they feel the physical aspect, the TNA, if I can use that term, maybe the TNA will lure viewers to watch the USA channel versus the guy in the you know, the hat with the cigars and the suit talking and luring people in. See, I became a fan of professional wrestling from guys that could talk me into the building. Not just the managers. I'm talking Ric Flair, Dusty Rhodes, Hulk Hogan, Steve Austin, all these guys. They were able to, they grabbed your attention and they made you tune in, or they made you buy a ticket to the live event, or they made you order the pay-per-view. That's called selling tickets. That's called increasing revenues. That's what the business is all about. It isn't about this guy having a five-star match or this guy being a great technician. It's about getting people to care about the product. And at the end of the day, when you look back at the recent boom periods in the pro wrestling industry, you can look back at the 80s and you could look back at the Attitude Era, and you could see that it was about guys and girls, guys that were talking customers into the building and getting them to tune in to the USA channel or TNT or buy the pay-per-view or buy the merchandise, I went all over the place with that one.
Well, I think that was a good answer. And I definitely agree with what you're saying in terms of a mouthpiece or a talker. That doesn't necessarily have to be a manager per se, because when you started to mention names that would pique interest in a product, you were mentioning guys that were popping into my brain exactly the same time. You said Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes, and I can think back to watching the Crockett shows of the 80s, 6:05 Saturday nights on WTBS. I was always upset when the baseball would interrupt it because I wanted to watch a show, and I'm thinking back to these shows that – largely what the show was 2 hours was squash matches, by today's standards, just total mismatches. But what was so compelling about the show were the characters that were talking to you and selling the show and selling the product. As you were saying, Ric Flair and Dusty Rhodes, Funky Lucky Monkey and all those great catch phrases that you would hear them. And then I'm thinking today, again, I go back probably to the same point of, managers. Why can't they find a role for a Dusty Rhodes on television today to manage somebody? Or now maybe a Ric Flair, who we've been hearing could possibly come back to WWE. I've heard talk that maybe they would replace Vicky Guerrero with Ric Flair as the manager of Dolph Ziggler. I mean, that possibly could be a new role for him. So, maybe at some point, the business model changes a little bit, or creatively they come up with something a little bit different. But maybe, maybe somewhere down the line, managers again have a more prominent role. Paul Heyman's back on the scene, who's one of the best talkers in the business, history of the wrestling business. So maybe, I don't know, you're sitting at home right now, but maybe somewhere down the line they say, hey, we could really use our Armando and bring back the role of a manager, and you can really help build the new stars of wrestling in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you hit it on the head when you said the business model. When you have a business model and it says, okay, this is the direction we're going in, and we feel that having attractive young women on television will lure in the demographic that we want, and we feel that that is the best way, cost wise, that is the best way to utilize our dollars, by paying a good looking model to just accompany this guy or that guy to the ring. And that model doesn't have to say a word. She just has to go out there and look good. And if they feel that that is where their dollars are best spent, then again, that's their decision to make. However, you get out what you put in. So you can pay a model a little bit of money to go out there and look good and generate you X amount of, maybe that model will help increase ratings by, half a percent, okay, or whatever the number is. Or you could pay a little bit more for somebody that has proven himself, somebody that works, something that works, not just myself, but a proven mouthpiece to go out there and to talk and to engage the audience, not just that male demographic, not just that, the 18 to 34, the coveted male demographic that has the most disposable income. But everybody, even Jim Ross, who, Jim Ross is a talker. Jim Ross was the reason I started paying attention to Mid-South UWF back in the 80s, because he made me want to watch the match, and then he made me want to tune in the following week, because he's got a powerful voice, because he's got passion, because he's charismatic, because he made you care, because he cared. And to me, you can't replace that. You can't just hire a girl who looks good and say, go out there and let's hope people watch you. There's pretty girls all over television, all over any form of media that you can, you know, that's accessible. I mean, does wrestling, especially now in a PG era, you know, and this isn't a knock on the valet. I think there have been some really good female managers. I think Vicky Guerrero does a great job. I think Sherry Martel did a great job. I think Fabulous Moolah was a great talker, you know, and was around for, you know, how many years, 40 years, 50 years. But there's something, you know, when we can sit here and have a conversation and instantly talk about, oh, managers, and the first thing that comes up is Bobby Heenan, and then we might say Jimmy Hart, we might say Jim Cornette, or Paul Heyman, or Freddie Blassie, or the Grand Wizard. And, you know, there's a reason we remember these guys. There is a reason that we remember all these great talkers. But if I asked you, well, start naming me some of these memorable valets, yeah, it's probably easy to say, oh, well, this girl looked good and this girl looked good. What else did she do? Anybody can look good. It's not just a cosmetic business. This is a business based on psychology. You have to be able to connect with the viewer at the end of the day.
And again, I think you nailed it again with Jim Ross and selling that Mid-South product, because that was a show that I really liked when I was growing up as well, was the syndicated Mid-South show, because, I mean, they jam-packed so much in that 60 minutes, and Jim Ross was selling that as 60 minutes. You know, television time remaining, and then we're going to show this match, and if we run out of time, we're going to pick up where we left off the next week. So it's you know, 5 minutes in this match, it's going on, it's getting hot, and all of a sudden the show ends, and then you know, as soon as it picks up the next week, here we are, right where we left off.
Yeah.
And here's this match, and here's Jim Ross selling this match as a great match, and we promised that we would deliver this match, and we've delivered this match to you. And it was just a special time. And Jim Ross, as you said, you know, great seller of the product.
Right.
Again, as a great commentator. And that kind of draws me to the next question, because I was thinking, you know, they were going to possibly use you in an on-air role. And if they don't use you as a manager or a general manager, you know, why didn't they maybe give you an opportunity to maybe try your luck at color commentary?
It's a good question. I mean, again, like I said earlier,
Did you ever pitch that idea to him? You know, you were talking that you were pitching ideas to him. I just wonder if you ever said, you know, maybe try me out as a color commentator. Maybe I could, you know, handle that role.
You know, I think I would do well with that, and that's a real hard job too. And I think anybody who's done that can tell you how hard that job is. I never actively pursued a role as an announcer, color commentator. Although I think I could do well at it if given the opportunity, because I am knowledgeable about the business and I am a storyteller and I believe I'm well-spoken and I know enough about a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And like I said, I'm a storyteller to help further the program or the characters or the storylines. But I never actively pursued that, you know, but hey, you never, again, you know, I look at Jerry Lawler, and it's good to see that Jerry's doing well, and Jerry will be back. But, you know, in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, I'll still be younger than Jerry is today. And, you know, again, if there's a need for a color commentator, maybe I'm available. It's got to make sense, you know. It's got to make sense.
Now, you mentioned AEW, and that was kind of a short-lived gimmick. You know, they put him on television. He was going to manage the primetime players there. And then obviously we saw what happened with that situation. I just wondered from your perspective with what happened with that situation, I guess, did you think that was fair for them to release him? And then what was your thoughts on all the Twitter rants that AEW did on WWE online?
Well, you know, it's not really, I guess it really doesn't matter if I think it's fair or not. They, you know, there's an election going on, and whether the powers that be want to admit that they are affiliated with, you know, the funding or sponsoring or the campaigning or whatever of that election is, you know, that's their prerogative. And if one of their performers came out and endorsed a candidate, whether that candidate has ties or doesn't have ties, wink, wink, is, again, it's unfortunate that he was made an example of, and he chose to express himself via social media. I could totally understand his frustration, and, you know, he said some things, and, hey, freedom of speech, and that's what's great about this country, because in some countries you couldn't do that, so. USA! USA! Sorry, that was my little Jim Duggan plug.
I think, obviously, a lot of the wrestling fans learned about you when you come on the scene with WWE. Not a lot of fans probably know about your OVW experience. Can you kind of talk about, you know, starting with OVW and some of the gimmicks you did in OVW?
Well, I came on board OVW in 2003. I trained, my first trainer was Nick Dinsmore, better known as Eugene. I eventually made my way up the ranks. Actually, OVW is where I started. I didn't do any indie wrestling or any wrestling at all until I walked into Ohio Valley Wrestling in Louisville, Kentucky. And I furthered my training with Rip Rogers, who is a phenomenal trainer, master of psychology, journeyman. He's been around a long time. I trained underneath Rip for about a year. And then I was invited to train with Al Snow and the developmental, the contracted program. Although I didn't have a contract, I think that was kind of like, okay, let's see if you could hang with the contracted talent, you know, and I did, and I ended up earning a contract eventually. But, you know, I had a lot of good teachers down there. Jim Cornette and Danny Davis, really helped me out a lot. As did Rip Rogers, as did Al Snow. Who else am I forgetting about? A couple of people. Tommy Dreamer was very instrumental in helping me get signed, as were the other guys. And then Paul Heyman. You know, Paul came in after I had reinvented my character. Originally, I was doing a throwback character like the Iron Sheik, kind of riding the Muhammad Hassan coattails in 2005. Jim Cornette actually first used me on TV as a bodyguard for Daivari and Muhammad Hassan prior to them debuting on Raw. And when they debuted, I stayed back, continuing to learn, continuing to understand and work and try to improve. And eventually there was talk of using me as part of Daivari and Hassan's group. And plans fell through, and those characters got axed. And then I was told that I needed to change my character altogether. So that was a bit frustrating because you work at something for so long, and as you're improving and you finally feel you're hitting your stride, it's like, you know, if you're, let me use another baseball analogy, if you're a catcher, you know, and you're working on catching and being the best catcher you can be, and then all of a sudden they tell you, hey, we don't want you to be a catcher. You got to learn to play third base. So it's like, okay, now I've got to be the best third baseman I can be. And I went back to the drawing board, and I came up with the Armando Estrada character. And with a lot of help from Al Snow and Paul Heyman, I just really started to find my groove as that performer. And shortly thereafter, you know, they brought me up as the mouthpiece for Eddie Fatu.
And I think a lot of people probably don't realize you had a character named Osama at that time in OVW.
Yeah. Jim Cornette decided to call me Osama, and that was my first on-air character as the bodyguard for the Daivari Muhammad Hassan. I kind of had a Mr. Hughes thing going on, and if you don't know what the Mr. Hughes thing is I didn't talk. All I did was meme mug everybody. So, you know, I had the beard going, I was in the suit, and I had the shades on, and I just had this evil, or not so much evil, but I had a look on my face that it basically told the story. It looked like I smelled something really bad. That's the Mr. Hughes look. Do you know Mr. Hughes? Remember Mr. Hughes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I had that going on for a little bit, and then I eventually started wrestling as Muhammad Hassan's cousin. I was Osama Hassan briefly, and you know, as I just grew into that character and I got more comfortable, and right when I was starting to really feel it, they were like, okay, you got to stop doing this and you got to come up with something new. So, but that was the best thing. That was the best thing that ever happened. So that's how I discovered my Armando persona.
You know, when you mentioned Hassan, that just kind of brought back some great memories. I really liked the direction they were going with that character, him and Daivari together. And it was just too bad, you know, what happened with that character. They ultimately had to pull it as an on-air character. But I thought they were doing a tremendous job. And it's just unfortunate that, I guess, maybe the circumstances and the way we were at that time, that, you know, they would have to pull that character. But what was it like working with Hassan and Daivari?
I mean, it was brief. You know, it wasn't very long. It was just, again, I had an idea. You know, I knew I wasn't going to be a part of their group for the big time, for Raw. But I was just happy to get a chance to do anything on TV and, you know, to do more than just security or extra work. I mean, so that was kind of cool because I hadn't been there that long when they had started, when Cornette started using me. So, you know, I thought those guys did a great job. Sean Daivari's probably, he's got one of the best minds in the wrestling business. I think Hassan just, I mean, the amount of, you know, heat that those guys had collectively was, we probably haven't seen that to this date, you know, going back to them. I don't think anybody has gotten or garnered the amount of heat that they did back in 2005. So it's unfortunate because they were just doing what they were told to do, and they got the plug pulled on them because the company just kind of pushed the envelope a little bit too far, and things that happened in the world and events that went on during that time period dictated a change in creative direction. So
talk about the call up when you finally got the call that they were going to bring you up from OVW to the main roster. How did that come about? How did you get the call? And what was your reaction when they told you the direction they were going to go with you as an on-air character?
Well, I had been working with Paul Heyman on TV, OVW TV, and I had been like the host of the show. I wasn't wrestling and I wasn't really managing. I was just kind of, I don't know if you'd call me an interviewer or a host. I was just kind of all over the show. I'd have multiple segments on the show, and it was just personality-based. And you know, I kept hearing rumblings from, you know, some of the decision makers in OVW that, you know, they're going to sign you, you're going to get signed, sit tight. So I eventually got a phone call from Danny Davis, and Danny told me that I would be going to Monday Night Raw to pretty much audition for the role of a manager. And, you know, I was excited, and I eventually went to Raw. I did my audition, and that audition was with 3-Minute Warning. That was Rosie and Jamal, and Rosie, who's, you know, best known as the superhero in training, member of 3-Minute Warning, tag team partner of the Hurricane, and Jamal, better known as Umaga. And I'd never met those guys. I'd never worked with them, and just went into the audition room and just kind of, you know, got my guidelines and just started talking, and it felt good. They felt good. We were kind of flowing together, and I could tell that, you know, I thought I did a great job. I thought I nailed it. And I got a call about 3 days later from John Laurinaitis, who offered me a booking contract with WWE. So I actually skipped the whole developmental contract, and I was given a TV contract, so to speak.
I definitely think you nailed it for sure. You were definitely getting over as a, you know, on-air talent with you know, managing Umaga, and I don't know. It just seems like they kind of missed the ball with you, because within a short time, you know, they put you to ECW as the general manager. Didn't it seem like at that time? Because I always, you know, I talked to people back in the business at that time when they had the, you know, that ECW. SmackDown and Raw, when they were actually doing the talent exchanges or the talent drafts, you know, if you were on the main show, Raw, and you got moved to SmackDown, it's like a demotion. If you went from SmackDown to ECW, that was a demotion. So What was your reaction when they moved you to ECW? Did you feel like it was kind of a demotion when you were on the main stage, you were on Raw?
I didn't, you know, at the time I didn't. I actually wasn't on TV for about 4 months, and then I wasn't even being brought to TV for about 10 weeks. And those 10 weeks that I wasn't being brought to Raw or SmackDown, I went back to OVW. And just because I don't know how to sit at home and not do anything, for me, that's just, I needed to be around wrestling and I needed to perform. So I went back to OVW in the summer of 07. And then I eventually got the call, you know, to re-debut as the ECW general manager, which I was fine with because I thought it was a great show with young talent that we're going to be given opportunities, that we're going to be given airtime. You know, I was on that show and it was, CM Punk had just started about a month before me on ECW. John Morrison was there. I think Kofi Kingston came in shortly thereafter. The Miz was there. We had Jack Swagger come in shortly after that. We had a lot of young talent. You know, Mike Knox. I know there's a few that are Elijah Burke. There's a lot of guys I can't think of right now, but I mean, just to give you an example there in those names that I listed, I thought it was a great platform for guys to get over that maybe wouldn't get that time on SmackDown or couldn't get that time on Raw. So I did not look at it as a demotion. I was just happy to be given another shot to show what I can do. So
I just wondered, obviously they went the direction with Umaga against Lashley at WrestleMania. I think that was about the time they really kind of took you away from Umaga. Did you feel like when they were going in that direction that would be, your role would be diminished greatly, or how did you approach that? What was your thought on that particular time period?
Well, when we were working with Lashley and Donald Trump and the whole deal there, you know, Vince McMahon stepped into the role as the mouthpiece. So if Umaga had Vince McMahon as his mouthpiece, no matter how good of a job I was doing, I mean, I'm not going to take the job from the boss or the owner of the company. If the owner of the company says, I'm going to manage Umaga and I'm going to be the mouthpiece of Umaga, well then, you know, you can't fight City Hall, as they say, right? If George Steinbrenner, who owns the New York Yankees, doesn't like the manager, or even though the manager is winning 100 games a year, the manager of the Yankees, if he says, well, hey, sorry, but I want to manage the Yankees, well, guess what? You step aside and you let him manage the Yankees, right?
Absolutely.
So, it was frustrating because I felt that with my respect to Eddie Fatu, may he rest in peace, I don't think he's in the main event of WrestleMania with Donald Trump and Vince McMahon. He's not in that high-profile match if it wasn't for me. And I firmly believe that. So, you know, for Vince to come in and kind of take the ball from me when I was at the inside the 20, you know, I had my eyes set on the end zone and I was going to score. And I knew I was going to score. And for him to take the ball away from me was a bit dejecting. But again, what do? You fight the boss?
No, I guess you did what you did. And they sent you at home for a while until they come up with the next direction for you, which was the ECW show at that time.
So,
right.
You know, it went the way they did. But, you know, there's a lot of guys who have, and I found this out the hard way, and there's guys finding it out the hard way right now. You know, they only want you to get as over as they want you to. So what that means is if you're supposed to be a main event star, if you're being groomed to be a main event star, then they want you to get a main event reaction. If you're not supposed to be a main event star, then you shouldn't be getting main event reactions. And that was the problem that happened to me. That's what's happening to guys like Zack Ryder right now. Because Zack Ryder, it's not his time to be a top star. So when Zack Ryder goes out there and gets one of the top three reactions of the night, they start pulling him off of TV, putting him in backstage segments, having him get beat up by everybody from monsters to midgets to girls, and just kind of, you know, make a buffoon out of the guy because it's not his time and they don't want him stealing that momentum from other guys or taking another guy's pop, so to speak. Again, it's their business model, and if that's how they want to run their business, then that's their prerogative.
At the end of your run in 2008, what did they tell you, and how did they give you the pink slip? Was it Johnny Unitas that kind of just pulls you to the side and says, hey, great work, but we have nothing for you at this time?
Well, that was the gist of it. I mean, it was I hadn't been on TV in a few months at that time, and again, I wasn't on TV. They stopped sending me to TV. What did I do? I flew myself down to Tampa, Florida to the developmental school, you know, because I never wanted to sit at home. If I wasn't going to be on Raw or SmackDown or ECW, I was going to go and work at the school and work on their TV and just get better and better and better and better. So I had been at FCW for a couple of weeks, and John Laurinaitis actually came down. And, you know, John was always good to me. John hired me. John gave me my raise. John gave me a second contract. John eventually rehired me. So John came down and talked to me in person. And you know, he was like, hey, you know, what's the deal? You know, and I said to him, well, you tell me. I've done everything that's been asked of me. I've gone above and beyond what's asked of me. I've gotten myself into the best shape of my life. I'm improving in every, you know, every way, shape, and form, in the ring, on the mic, and just, you know, trying to go to the next level. You know, does creative have any plans for me? And he flat out said no. And I says, well, what do you think I should do? And he said, I think you need to go work elsewhere. And I says, okay, well, then let's make that happen. So he granted me my release, and you know, he said the door was open for me to come back when the time was right, which I did. So when he wanted me to go work elsewhere, the problem with that is there's not a lot of places to go and work and to get good, you know. And I ended up pursuing another path at that time. I stayed away from wrestling for a little bit with the occasional indie here and there. And I went into the restaurant business, and I learned a hell of a lot in the restaurant business. Working for myself and being owner-operator of a restaurant is not anything I wish on anybody, but if you've done it, you know the work ethic that it takes and the dedication and sacrifices that it takes. I used to tell people that owning a restaurant was harder than making those long 5-hour drives from Chicago to Louisville, Kentucky, to go train for 2 hours, then get beat up, then go to a live event, set up the ring, sit in the crowd for 3 hours, pretend to be a fan, tear down the ring, then drive home 5 hours. That was easier than running a restaurant. So
I think anybody that's ever owned a business, it's different than working for the man. As my friend always said, it's, you know, I'm working for the man, and I don't like it, but the flip side is owning your own business, and then you have no rest. You're the boss. It's your business.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if you don't take care of your business, it's going to fail.
Nobody. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, nobody will take care of your business the way you would. Just like, you know, if you're a father or a mother, nobody's going to take care of your kid the way you will. Right?
That's true. Exactly.
Yeah.
How did you learn of Eddie Fatu's passing?
I got a phone call. While I was at my home in Chicago, and one of my former colleagues called me and said, he's passed on. And I was stunned, absolutely stunned. And, it's just sad. It was just a sad, sad reality.
Can you tell us any positive stories about Umaga, Road Story, something behind the scene that we didn't get a chance to see that, could help us, have a positive view of Umaga?
You know, he was a very big-hearted guy. If he liked you, he'd go out of his way for you. If he didn't like you, get out of his way and don't let him see you. So it was one of those, you know, he either really liked you or he didn't like you. And I don't think he liked me in the beginnings and maybe towards the middle, because maybe there was some, you know, he's supposed to be the star of the team, so to speak, but I was getting more adulation. I don't know. But with that said, eventually, you know, when he started seeing where he was going career-wise, I think he took a warming to me. He took a liking to me, and, you know, we got along. And like I said, he was very, very big heart. A lot of the Samoan family, those guys are very generous and giving. And, you know, they look out for you. Brada, 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 brada. So, yeah, he was a funny guy, family guy. He loved his sons. You know, he had four boys, a wife, always talked about his kids. And, you know, I miss him.
They brought you back, you know, for a time to manage, I guess for a very short time to manage Tyson Kidd. I just wonder what your thoughts on Tyson Kidd is in terms of his future. Do you ever see him maybe getting a push into a higher role with WWE?
I like Tyson. I think he's one of the best technicians in the world. He's been wrestling since he could walk. He's been around the business. He gets it. He's not a second or third generation guy, but he might as well be, as far as the knowledge and just being around it all his life. You know, if Tyson was 6'2", he'd probably be, you know, in the main events. You know, and I look at Daniel Bryan and I say, well, he's not 6'2". They're about the same size. But, you know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of small guys that have spots on the higher end of the card, on the upper part of the card. You know, they're far, you know, very few and far in between. You know, you look at Rey Mysterio, Daniel Bryan. That's really about it that comes to mind as far as the guys that aren't, you know, 6'2", 275, you know. So
true.
It's timing. Again, timing is everything. You know, I think that's the guy. He can work, I think, wherever he wants to work. If he wants to work for WWE, he can work for WWE. If he wants to go to another organization, he can. If he wants to go back to Japan or Mexico or Canada or Germany, he can, because he's good. And when you're good and solid like Tyson, you'll have a job in the business for a long time.
What was your thoughts when OVW and WWE's relationship ended in terms of a developmental system, and then what's your thoughts on OVW today working with TNA?
I was sad to hear that WWE decided to pull their developmental program from there, being, you know, again, it was where I started. So, and seeing how much talent came out of OVW, you know, guys like myself. And although, you know, he's trained all over the world, CM Punk called OVW home for a couple of years. You know, Kofi Kingston, Cody Rhodes, there's so many guys. You know, you can go back to Cena, you can go back to Batista, you can go back to Brock Lesnar, Shelton Benjamin, all these guys, Randy Orton, they all called OVW home. You know, and Danny Davis runs a hell of an operation down there. He gives you an education in the business, I think, like no other. And, it'll always have a special place in my heart, you know.
Is there any possibility we may see you pop up in TNA?
Well, anything's a possibility, I suppose. You know, I know some of the decision makers over there, and they know how to get in touch with me, so... Again, you know, timing is everything. You know, there's certain things that some wrestling fans may not understand about, oh, why don't you just go and work here, and why don't you go work there?
Yeah.
You know, if
right.
I'll put it in a different scenario. If there's a Starbucks on the corner and there's 10 positions there and all 10 are filled, they can't just hire an 11th, you know, whatever they call their employees or their coffee makers or whatever. They can't just bring in an 11th guy on the team. They've only got 10. They've got 10 spots. So unless one of them leaves or, you know, transfers or quit or whatever, you know, you can't just go and fill its big payroll too, right? If you've got, if it's your business and you, your payroll is for 10 people, you can't hire an 11th guy, right?
Right.
So that's just the nature of it. I've said timing so many times, but that's what it is. That's, timing is everything in life, right?
Well, let me ask it a different way. Have they reached out to you, or have you reached out to them? Either way.
Well, we've talked, but again, just like what I said, it's about timing. It's about a spot. Again, if their roster is full, then they would have to dump somebody off of that roster to accommodate a new talent. So, and especially when they look like they've filled a lot of, I don't want to say positions or spots, but, you know, they've got the program going on with Aces and Eights, which who knows how many people will eventually come out of that as far as new talents, old talents, but there's a lot of guys underneath those hoods, right? So there's money being invested in those guys right now. So that's the direction that they're going in, and if it changes, you know, then if it makes sense for an organization, whether it's TNA or another company, to bring in Armando Estrada, if they feel that there's a spot for me and an opportunity for me, and they want to make that investment, then I'll give them the return on that investment. So you got to spend money to make money, right?
Absolutely.
Don't just make money. You can't make a quarter unless you spend a dime, and you can't make a million unless you know what I mean. So you got to spend.
Right. Do you think Linda McMahon would make a good U.S. senator?
Wow, what a loaded question. I don't know enough about her as far as – I didn't interact with her. She wasn't around. You know, she wasn't – I was on the road, so I was around Vince more, and I was around Stephanie more, and I was even around Shane more. So I can't really answer that question as far as what kind of a leader she would be. But if she's anything like – if she has any of the drive and determination and passion that Vince McMahon has, then I think she can do whatever she wants to do and make it successful.
What do you think when you see Jonathan Coachman on ESPN?
Good for him. I love the coach. Always have. He's always a fan. And I was there when he was on his way out, and he was telling me about how great it was over there. And I says, hey, man, you've got a wife, you've got a kid, I think he's got two kids now. If that's what's best for you and your family, congratulations, whatever makes you happy. I like to say, hey, I used to work with that guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You guys
Same
are
thing
both,
with Todd Grisham.
You guys are two very talented people. So
thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. We've seen the last couple of weeks Raw's ratings really going down, 2.7, 2.5. You know, we're seeing this, and I've always said ratings kind of go in cycles. They go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. I guess just in general, what do you think is kind of wrong with WWE? Why do you think the product is kind of stale, and why do you kind of think the ratings are going down right now?
Well, I think the first reason is you got to take into consideration Monday Night Football being back on the air and having the Chicago Bears play the Dallas Cowboys is a pretty – the hard show to lure viewers away from. I don't care what's going on. I mean, you've got, not only is it football, not only is it Chicago, but it's the Cowboys too. So I would not want to go head to head with Monday Night Football because they are just, you know, their schedule, the schedule makers, they've loaded up some pretty big rivalries and pretty big markets, for the rest of the season. So it's tough because they've been on for so long and it's such a tradition, and it takes away some of that adult viewership. You know, the kids aren't necessarily tuning away from Raw. but I just think there's a lot of competition on Monday night. And I think there's a couple, you know, I'm not too familiar with outside of wrestling and football on Monday nights, but I know that there's at least another show or two that pulls viewership, that brings in, you know, viewership. So it's going to be a tough, 8 or 9 months for the WWE, but, you know, it's nothing new. It's nothing new that they haven't experienced before. And, they've got some real talented guys on the creative team there that are just going to have to, you know, come up with some different ideas to captivate the audience. And they've been doing it for so long that, you know, it's probably like waking up in the morning and grabbing a cup of coffee. It's a routine.
And I agree with that, but on the same time, I think them expanding the 3 hours didn't help themselves at all. I think that's really I understand that you expand, you get 3 hours, you get more television time, more television exposure for your product, obviously more money in terms of television rights.
And that's the first thing.
I understand. More money. And I understand. Yeah, I understand from go back to the business model. I understand it. They're making more money from the USA Network, but at the same time, you got SmackDown, you've got NXT, you've got Superstars, you got Main Event last night debuted on ION. You got Saturday Morning Slam. That's a lot of programming to be pumping out there. And, you know, I think there is a level of overexposure right now, especially at a time when your product is not real hot. You don't have stars like The Rock and Stone Cold Steve Austin to grip people. And you have to really wonder if the timing of them moving to 3 hours really made a lot of sense in the long term.
Hey, it may not make a lot of sense, but to quote another great manager from the past, it's all about the money. That's my little shout out to Slick, aka Reverend Slick, who, if you've ever met Slick, is one of the taller guys I've ever been around. It's like, wow, you're a tall dude, but I didn't know that because you were standing next to Akeem and the Big Boss Man. Anyway. Yeah, it's all about the money. So if USA Network is going to give them X amount of dollars to produce a third hour, you know, and that's going to get more eyeballs on the product. So while I understand your argument that the product may suffer creatively because that's just so much more that they have to come up with, I think what you're going to see is you're going to start seeing longer matches. You're going to start seeing more performers. You're going to start seeing tag team matches, which they just kicked off this tag team tournament. So there seems to be at least a renewed push for the tag team division. And those are positives. Those are positives. Now, you know, again, it's a 3 hour show and maybe most people don't have the full 3 hours to invest. So they're going to have to kind of pick and choose when they watch or what they watch, or if they have, you know, if they have a DVR, yeah, it's good for the company because they're going to get more eyeballs on their product. You're going to see guys like CM Punk get more segments as they continue to push him and elevate him as their next top guy. You know, it's good for guys that are up and coming like Dolph Ziggler, who's going to get more talk time and more opportunities to showcase what he can do. You know, it's good for guys like Kofi Kingston. It's good for guys like Cody Rhodes. It's good for guys like Damian Sandow. All these guys that, you know, I like to think of the WWE as in a transitional mode right now on so many levels, but mainly on the performer side. You've got all these guys that are on the cusp. They're all these AA ball players or AAA ball players that are on the cusp of being called up and making it to the big time. And I mean that in the sense of, when you've got all your prize, when you've got all your top studs in AA, you know, when your AA program is loaded with talent, you can't wait to unleash them on the majors because you know how good they're going to be. And I think that's what you're seeing with those guys that I named. Once they get comfortable, you know, they're going to start working so much more. And that's how you get good. I was always taught repetition, repetition, repetition. You know, go out there 10 minutes, then go out there for 12 minutes. Then go out there for 15 minutes, and every time you get better and better and better, better, and your confidence improves, and your matches improve, and your ability to connect with the audience, whether it be through body language, physicals, physical movement, facial expressions, or verbal expressions, promos. All that stuff helps you connect and improve and go to the next level. So I think you're seeing a lot of guys right now on the program that are going to be main eventing pay-per-views for many years to come.
You definitely use a lot of sports metaphors, and I think if people follow you on Twitter, because I do follow you on Twitter, and I do enjoy some of the tweets you put out there. I know you made some comments last night about the debate, the big political debate last night, and you've always made some comments on what's going on in the sports world. I always find your tweets very interesting, so maybe you want to go ahead and plug your Twitter. I don't know if you're on Facebook, social media.
Yeah, I take pride in either being informative or entertaining. I try to be as entertaining as possible all the time. And it's whatever comes out of my mind. You know, whatever comes to the top of my head, I'm going to, I'm going to take social media and I'm going to let my audience hear my thoughts. So you can follow me on Twitter at Real Armando. Ha ha. That's Real Armando. H-A-H-A. I am on Facebook as well. Facebook.com. Is it // or /? Because I get those two confused. Which one would it be?
I think it's /.
Okay, whatever the slash is, whichever slash. Facebook/ Armando.Estrada.50. I think that's what it is. Yeah, so, yeah, and if there's any wrestling bookers or promoters who'd like to bring me in to entertain, to wrestle, to manage, to general manage, to wrestle a bear, to juggle, to play hopscotch, to throw darts at the fans, you can reach me at bookarmando@yahoo.com. So.
And the good thing is, if they didn't catch that, we'll definitely plug that on the website when we post this interview and give a chance for everybody to either, follow you on Twitter or like you on Facebook, or if anybody, as you said, any bookers out there that want to book you for a show. And I know you got some shows coming up, or at least one show coming up. Any upcoming appearances you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I've got a few actually coming up. Friday, October 12th, I will be performing for Pro Wrestling Syndicate in Rahway, New Jersey at the Rahway Rec Center. You'll see the likes of Big Van Vader, Rikishi, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, the Iron Sheik Bebe. That was kind of an Iron Sheik Dusty Rhodes that didn't really flow. Yeah.
That's quite a mixture right there.
That was a mixture. But no, Dusty, I don't know that Dusty will be there, but the Iron Sheik will be. Tugboat, also known as Typhoon, a.k.a. the Shockmaster, will be there in attendance at Pro Wrestling Syndicate. Once again, that's Friday, October 12th in Rahway, New Jersey. And the next night, Saturday, October 13th, I'll be appearing for Legends Mania. That is in Monroe, New Jersey. And I will be appearing alongside Dr. Tom Pritchard, Paul Bitter, Jimmy Hart. How about that for a wrestling wrestling manager contingent? You got Dr. Tom, Paul Bearer, Jimmy Hart, and myself, along with DDP, Diamond Dallas Page himself, Saturday, October 13th, Legends Mania, Monroe, New Jersey. Come meet me and a bunch of other guys who aren't as entertained. No, I'm just kidding. It'll be a good show. Looking forward to it, man. Looking forward to it. New Jersey, come and see me.
Well, definitely. I definitely encourage people to follow you on Twitter. As I said, I do follow you on Twitter, and I do enjoy your tweets, and I definitely would encourage people to check you out on Facebook. And we do appreciate your time today. We've been trying to hook up with you for a while, and glad we got a chance to talk to you, get to know you a little bit better, and maybe tell your story to a new audience here at GirlWick.net. So we do appreciate it. We really enjoyed your work in WWE, and we hope to see you real soon on the big stage, if it's with WWE, TNA, wherever it might be. We'd like to see more of you in the future. So we do appreciate it, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks for your time. Signing off, my name is Armando Alejandro Estrada. And P.S., I own my name.